Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about preventing mommy burnout. You know you've likely felt it. Today, we're going to be talking about it and what you can do about it. I really enjoyed this show. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
We are on not just choice overload, but we're also on information overload. So we know. And everything you can Google, anything and everything, right? So does that have red dye in it? Did that have this? Does it have formaldehyde? And, you know, and most of the things are scary. So you think, oh, well, thank goodness we know this. However, what it's doing is creating a fear, a culture of fear.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. We have a new e-guide, or sorry, actually new, we have a guide on adoption announcements. It is cute, fun, full of pictures. Check it out on our website, creatingafamily.org. You can hover over resources, and you will see the guide there, and you can click on it and download it at that point. The Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by the Jockey Bing Family Foundation. Their mission is to strengthen adoptive families through post-adoption services. As their founder, Deborah Waller, who is chairman and CEO of Jockey International, says, one failed adoption is one too many. You can support their mission by buying a bear or a blanket at their newly revised website, jockeybeingfamily.com. And we thank them for their support. Today we're going to be talking about preventing mommy burnout. Our guest is Dr. Cheryl Ziegler. She is a psychotherapist and author of a new book, Mommy Burnout, How to Reclaim Your Life and Raise Healthier Children in the Process. Welcome, Dr. Ziegler, to Creating a Family.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am so looking forward to this interview. I really enjoyed the book, and it rang true to me on both a personal level, but it also rang true because one of the things we do at Creating a Family is we have a really large online support group for people who have either adopted or are fostering children, or people who have who are currently or have struggled with infertility. And I see so much of the of this book really dealt with the issues that I see daily. As one of the moderators in our Facebook support group, it really did hit home. So I wanted to start, though, as I was reading the book, and I should say I'm also a parent and also understand intuitively as well as from personal experience the whole concept of mommy burnout. Now, my kids are getting older, so I'm in a different stage, and so in some ways I have a little perspective on it, in some ways I don't. So I think that's just how it is. How is parenting in this decade of the 21st century different from parenting, say, 20 or 30 years ago? And how does that relate
to
burnout?
Well, I love that you start with that question, because that's almost the question that I started with myself.
Mm-hmm.
I have a private practice, and I was seeing this pattern really day after day after day of women sort of saying the same things. I'm so exhausted. I'm so over this. When, you know, is this it? Is like, you know, those kinds of questions. And so I wanted to understand, did other generations feel this way? You know, what's different? What's unique? So
is this just universal of parentinghood? Yeah, parenthood, you know?
Right.
Or is this different?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I really, really wanted to understand. And so some of the things that I have found that help me understand how we have gotten to where we are a couple of things. The first one is certainly generations of moms before us felt stress. There's no doubt about it. And burnout is really chronic stress. And so they felt it. However, they dealt with it, talked about it, and lived with it quite differently. So in the late 50s, early 60s, when people would talk about mommy's little helper, the little yellow pill, was actually Valium. And so that's how they were dealing with it. They would not talk about it. That would not have been, you know, something societally in America that people would have talked about, but they would go to their doctors. And unfortunately, at the time, the majority of the view would have been to say, well, you're hysterical. Here, take a pill. and basically calm down, you know? So that was their generation. Then the equal rights movement came, and so all of these women's rights came about, and interestingly, what the data shows is that men have benefited more from the equal rights movement than women have. Because what happened at that period of time, right, ironically, is we said, well, now I can just do it all. I'm not going to actually give anything up. Mm-hmm. So I'm still going to cook and clean and raise kids. And I'm going to go, you know, work at some company, become a CEO, whatever I want to do. Go back to school maybe, because at the time, women weren't even allowed to go to absolutely any university they wanted. They were still, even some they couldn't. So it's been an interesting evolution and historically to look to see. And they started talking about burnout and motherhood really in the 90s, mid to late 90s, is when it started to come about. I think, like, women were finally realizing, like, this is so hard and actually we can't have it all. And this notion that we thought we were going to have it all isn't a reality. And so one of the very unique things that brings us to, you know, right now in 2018 is social media. And that's one of the very, very unique qualities of what is really fueling a level of stress to the point where, you know, we started off with bloggers blogging about, like, jokes and crying in closets and hiding from kids in pantries. And,
they were blogging about the perfect meals they were fixing their family every night. Well, my family
you're
was
right.
eating leftovers. Yep. That's what
exactly.
They were blogging about.
I mean, it did. It started off like that, like Pinterest, and there's still plenty of that, these Pinterest perfect kind of images. And then it became like then jokes about the trials and tribulations of motherhood. And now I think we are open and ready to really talk about, like, where I really come from in this is an actual mental and physical health crisis for women. And it's not funny, right? And it's not something that benefits us if we don't talk about it. So it's just like this whole evolution of what's been happening. But social media in particular does. It portrays images of oftentimes perfection, and if not perfection, at the very least, what you don't have. You know, you don't have the kid who's the star of the soccer team, or you don't have the kid who's amazing at this or that, or this vacation or this car, your husband doesn't make enough money, whatever it is. And so those kinds of things, you know, people are concerned about, and they should be, about teenagers and social media. And I'm also concerned, though, about moms and social media and women's health and social media and what it's doing to us.
Yeah, because people don't post that they're hiding in the bathroom with the door shut, pretending to go to the bathroom so that they don't have to listen to their kids or don't have to play another round of Candyland or whatever.
Exactly.
You know, they're not posting that. You know, what they post that night is a picture of their perfectly set table, and oftentimes, and this one really drives me crazy, the kids are just sitting there like little angels smiling and at the table, as opposed to having a face that says, "Ew, I don't like this," or, you know, "Why couldn't I have peanut butter," or whatever. So, yeah, they're
exactly.
not, everybody's, well, and then that's, I guess, human nature, that we always want to put our best foot forward. But now we have access to it. One of the things that you talked about that you really stressed actually just throughout the book, and I found it fascinating and interesting, and something, quite frankly, that I wouldn't necessarily have thought that you would have put such emphasis on, and that is the importance of friends. And you make a statement in the books that moms now have fewer close and intimate friendships than in the past, and that I wonder if social media plays into that. But why? Why do we? That surprised me. Why do we as women have fewer close and intimate friendships now?
Well, I'm so glad you bring that up, because I actually go so far in the book as to say I believe my practice would be cut in half if every woman had a close, intimate friend.
Yeah,
and,
I think, yeah, I see that.
That's a pretty bold statement, and that has been my thought for years. Women are more socially isolated. In general, Americans are more socially isolated than ever, although we are more digitally connected than ever. And so one of the things that's going on is there's so many, like, again, I love to look at, like, history and how do we get here, but suburbia sort of started it really a long time ago. People used to live in a lot more, you know, urban areas, and then suburbia came, and then when suburbia came, came fences and came more distance and came a lot more driving. So the socialization and all of that, just, you know, it was something that was actually quite noted, right? But where we, and then fast forward that to today, we are just not befriending people the way we used to. We don't look up from our phones very often. If there's a minute of quiet time, or you're standing on the line in a grocery store, or you're at the airport waiting for security, what's everybody doing, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has their phone out. And everybody is scrolling through social media. And we are also, because of our opportunities with education and employment, women are moving around a lot more. So it's not as likely that, you know, you grew up in Ohio and you went to school in Ohio and now you go back to your hometown, or at least your home county, and get married and raise kids. That's not as common. What's more common is that you go to school in one state and then you, you know, get a job opportunity in another one, and then you meet your husband there, and together you might move to a third state, or, you know, even spend some years traveling outside of the country. So the mere fact that people are moving around is also contributing to more loneliness. So a lot of women will say to me, first of all, the title of the chapter is, "Didn't I used to have friends?" Like, most women will be like, "Oh, there was really a time where I was really social, and I had a lot of fun, and I had a lot of friends." And, you know, we are getting more isolated, and we think that social media is replacing, or at the very least, like, a really good Band-Aid for this, but really it isn't. And what happens is, you know, never mind, you know, like, Facebook. Let's just say texting.
I love texting, right?
It's so easy. It's convenient. I love it. And in some ways, it's great because I can let somebody know I'm thinking about them, you know, in a heartbeat and not have to disrupt my life or anything. However,
having to spend time taking my busy schedule to have to,
yes.
And I can't control the phone conversation with the text. I'm in control of how much time I spend. Yeah, I love
yes.
it.
Yes. And, you know, what's so interesting, though, is let's say you and I are friends and, you know, I'm in the middle of a huge argument with my husband and you call. If I pick up the phone and I'm like, "Hi," you're going to know, like, you're what's going on? Are you okay? And I'm going to have to actually be more authentic and answer you and talk to you. But if I'm in the middle of a huge argument, or I just got fired, something pretty big just happened, I'm sitting here, I'm crying, and you text me, "Hey, thinking of you, how's it going?" What can I do? I can so easily reply with an emoji, even, without even words. I can just smiley face, I can send you a heart, I can say, "Everything's great, how are you?" And I don't risk that emotional vulnerability. And so now with this invention, really, of technology, we are spending less time face-to-face, which is the ideal. People will ask me, "Well, do you think that technology, at the very least, though, it connects people, and so does it help?" And, you know, for the most part, it's like a Band-Aid. So it does help when you're missing someone across the country. The fact that you can text them or see pictures of their kids every day is great. But it doesn't replace the actual emotional needs that human beings have, and that is to be in proximity with others that make you feel good, and that is to be giving eye contact and hugs and touching. Hormonally, they say oxytocin, the love hormone, gets stimulated in the presence of another woman who you're, you know, positively engaged with. You can't get that even on the phone, and you certainly cannot get that through technology. So you're right. When people say, "Well, what's the one takeaway?" If you just had to say one, and I say there's so many, but if you just had to say one, I say through the research and my own experience, the number one thing that women can do is befriend their friends. Connect with old ones, make new ones, start talking to neighbors, because we need also different levels of friendship. It's
exactly.
Not all about go find a best friend. It's not that at all. It's you can be friendly with the 70-year-old woman across the street because, you know what, you're going to learn something from her. You might need something from her. She might need something from you that makes you feel useful and helpful. All the way to, like, in my case, I still have a preschooler, so that I'm raising my child, my youngest child, next to women who are literally 10 and 12 years younger than me. right? But we can still relate. I don't look at them as, well, I mean, I'm 10, 12 years older than them. I'm not going to even befriend them. I've really learned to, and maybe I used to be a little bit more like that, honestly. Like, I would look for people who I really thought I would hit it off with, that I had a lot in common with, and I don't do that anymore. There's so much value in all different types of female friendships.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said, I mean, we don't all of our friendships don't have to be the kindred spirits that of Anne, as Anne of Green Gables would say. You know, I call them friendships of convenience, and that makes it sound, shallow. And maybe in some way it is, but when, especially when my children were very little, the people next door who had a similar age child, this woman and I would have had almost nothing in common, other than the fact that we were both moms of similarly aged kids, which made us have a lot in common. You know, and truthfully, the friendship hasn't necessarily been something that once we moved away, it wasn't a friendship that continued. But it was wonderful during that time, and it fulfilled a need, even though, again, she wasn't my bosom buddy or whatever. So I'm glad you... that you talk about the different levels of friendship. You know, the person that you see at the gym who happens to be going at the same time because that's when the gym has childcare, is somebody that you can, you know, correspond with and have something in common with just because you both work out and you both have kids.
Right. Well, I mean, even on that note, she might be the person that the only thing that you have in common is you've decided you're going to be accountability partners, you know, and you say, I expect to see you here every Monday and Wednesday, and I'm going to send you a text, even, or I'm going to call you and make sure you meet me here. How invaluable would that be?
Very. It would be very valuable.
Very.
I need one.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. let's talk a little about the stay-at-home mom versus working moms. From my vantage point of running this really large support group, there seems to me, people say, well, there's no longer the mommy wars, but I still see it. And both sides think that they are the more stressed. So let's talk a little about, you want to solve that? You want to tell us which one is the most stressed?
The most stressed group of moms are stay-at-home moms. So, and you would maybe think it was the other way, but stress doesn't, you know, when we say stress, that's subjective, right? So, here's what I see. I don't think that we have a ton not in common. We have more in common, meaning stay-at-home moms and working moms have more in common in terms of feelings, core fundamental feelings, than they have dissimilar feelings. And so here's what I mean. The stay-at-home mom, she says, this is an average sort of session for me. She'll say, well, you know, I've got, you know, two kids and I stay at home now, but you know, I just want to let you know, I have an MBA and I used to run my own company. I used to be the head of a division at this company and I had a career for 10 years before I ever, you know, started kids or before I decided to stay home. And so, you know, women pushing the age back in which they have children has contributed to this because they have longer just life. They have life stories. They have a whole, usually truly like a decade of experience, of traveling, of working, of being educated, in which all of a sudden when they become a stay-at-home mom, they're like, whoa, where's the girl who, you know, backpacked across Europe and ran, you know, the HR department at this company, you know? So oftentimes in my experience, there's that. And so they question what they are contributing to the world, and they question their purpose. What is this for? What am I doing? You know, how is doing laundry and dishes and cooking and cleaning, how is that productive in the world? And so those are the kinds of questions that they grapple with.
Let me throw something else in that I hear from people, you know, that are staying at home, which is, this is not a jab at either decision, that both have value, but whether or not to stay home or to work and parent. But moms will say, my only job is these kids. And, you know, that, so I've got to treat it as a job. I've got to do the best job I can possibly do, because this is my measurement now of what I'm doing, a measurement of who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And I think the notion of motherhood as job, I find, of course, because I read and want to hear so much about people's thoughts about motherhood, is kind of controversial. there's definitely a camp of moms that are like, heck yeah, this is a job. And then there's another camp of moms that are like, we shouldn't view it that way. And, I mean, I think that there's a personal choice there. I sort of professionally and personally, I do think it's like a job. And quite frankly, I think that the women who approach it like a job, and I don't mean going to the extreme where their ultimate goal is actual perfectionism, but mm-hmm. women who really approach it, because if you approach it as a job, it gives it a purpose, like a really big purpose, right? Because when your kids are 2 and 3, you're really getting through the day, you know, and sometimes you're staring at your watch, like when is nap time and when is bedtime, and, you know, and so you've got to think of it in the bigger picture that you are not just contributing to your community, but you're contributing to the world by raising loving, emotionally intelligent human beings that care, you know? And so mm-hmm. that's the way I talk to stay-at-home moms about it, is think of this as the world's most important job. People say it, but let's walk our talk. We say being a parent is the most important job and the hardest job that anybody could ever have. Well, mm-hmm. treat it as such. Really. Treat yourself like you're a hero that day because you taught your kid, whether they're a toddler or a high school kid, you taught them to be kind. You taught them to be accepting of everyone and celebrate diversity. You know, so when I talk to stay-at-home moms, that's how I talk to them, the way I would talk to somebody if I was coaching them through an employee situation. And
but Dr. Ziegler, let me interrupt here a second. Doesn't that, however, lead to us or the temptation to judge our value or our success at our job by how our children are behave, because I can spend a lot of time teaching my children to be kind, and then my kid acts unkind and mm-hmm. does something bad, or my kid I find out that my kid has bullied another child. So isn't that idea that this is our job? Does that not contribute to then valuing of ourselves based on how our children behave?
I absolutely think it can run that risk. And I think if any of us, let's say we had employees, if any of us thinks that we are going to fully control somebody else, whether you are their mother or you are their boss, we really need to rethink that. And we need to understand that what we are doing are raising children, instilling values, holding them accountable, and doing it 1,000, 100,000 times so that hopefully their brain is wired to act and behave and feel certain ways. But at the end of the day, and especially if we are talking about parents who are raising children who are adopted, which is an area of expertise that I've had for a long time, there are so many other factors that the idea that you are doing your best and that you knew you were consistent and you did your best and you supported it in every way has got to be good enough. That's what we're measuring. Did I do my best? Not did my kid do their best. Did I do my best today? If my kid becomes a bully or my kid is not kind to somebody, sure, I'm going to evaluate. What, you know, did I miss something? Did I, you know, and then when I can look at myself in the eye or look at anybody in the eye and say, you know, I taught him differently or I taught them better. That's what we're measuring. Did I teach
them? Oh, my kid
them?
Made a
not
mistake.
Did they perform?
We're humans.
Right.
My kid
they're
will
humans.
Make mistakes.
And
I'm not.
Kids.
Yeah, and they're kids.
I'm not responsible.
Mm-hmm. And that we do it the best, and we also have to model to our children that they can make mistakes and we can make mistakes and we can get over them. You raised a really before we go off on the we've been talking only at stay at home, so let me just circle back.
Yeah, working.
And talk some about working moms, because I think that there is some feeling that they then have to make up for the fact when they come home, they have to make up for the fact that they've been gone during the working hours of the day, and that adds a lot of stress.
Absolutely. So the working moms that I work with, when they are in either, you know, high levels of stress or they've gotten to the point of burnout, what we're talking about is they're saying, I am busting my butt at home. I'm busting my butt at work, and I am putting in, you know, more hours than I could possibly. I hardly ever sleep. And, you know, I'm running around all over the place all the time. I'm late for everything. You know, I'm sneaking out. I'm trying to, you know, all those things. And they'll look at me and they'll just say, for what? Why am I doing this to myself? And then that's what we explore. Okay, let's talk about this. Why are you doing this to yourself? what do you get out of work? You know, maybe literally you need to work. It's, so you can still feel this way, though. So people will say to me, well, is that just, you know, privilege to think about whether to work or not? And the feelings are the same. So let's just say, like, working is not an option. You absolutely, you are the breadwinner of your family, or you are a single parent. So working, you know, full-time is the only option for you. You are still entitled, though, to have the thoughts and feelings of, what am I doing this for? You know, like women will come to that when they're working and they go, do you know that pretty much 75 to 80% of my paycheck just goes to childcare? You know, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this to myself? And then there are times where they go, hey, if I make some life adjustments, you know, I can stay home, or I can work part-time, or whatever it might be. So that's the question they ask, what is this for? And then the guilt. I mean, I think mm-hmm. every mom deals with guilt, but I find mm-hmm. that working moms have even higher levels of guilt. And that is something that guilt will never, ever get us to a point of wellness. Guilt doesn't serve us. It really, really doesn't.
No. And, yeah, I can see your amen. You are listening to an interview.
Really, yeah, I feel passionate about it.
Yeah, I do. I can tell, and I do as well. You are listening to an interview on Creating a Family with the author of Mommy Burnout, Dr. Cheryl Ziegler. I wanted to talk some about perfectionism. You talk about it. You mentioned it just a minute ago. It's almost, and you use the term the proliferation of choice, and we certainly have, and I am so guilty of this. I mean, I'm getting ready to buy a microwave, and I sit there standing in the aisle Googling, you know, all the reviews of microwaves, and then, you know, can't find the one that's been ranked number one by whomever. And I can't find it, so then I'm going to three different stores looking for this, and then, you know, that type of thing. I'm finding the best product, but it goes beyond that from a parenting standpoint. You know, finding the what is the best car seat, what is the best gymnastics program, what's the best kindergarten, for gracious sakes, and so it becomes that becomes a job in and of itself. It becomes overwhelming with all the options that we currently have, and all the options for things to do. Our kids can be in gymnastics or dance or tennis. I'll script the or, let's make it and, that they can do all of these. And if we don't have our kids in all these activities, it's the old FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. Worse, because we're going to be screwing our kids around because we haven't provided the optimum, you know, how do we know? Maybe my kid would be a piano virtuoso if, you know, if we could just figure out a time to get her into piano lessons.
Absolutely. I came across the first time, you know, like you kind of feel it sometimes. It's like a funny joke. Like think about how big, you know, Babies R Us or Bye Bye Baby, like just how huge these stores are, right? So I feel like, you know, when you become a first-time mm-hmm. parent, yes, you acknowledge, look at all these options there are, but you're excited. You're just like, oh, this is, you know, exciting, mm-hmm. certainly, and especially if, you know, you've been trying for a long time and you finally are at that point. And so it's just everything's exciting. However, that lasts for a very short amount of time, and you get in there and you go, oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, what wipes should I get? Should I get natural care? Should I pay double for organic? Should I, right? And then you've got all these questions. So I, like everybody else, just sort of realize that you feel overwhelmed, and then, you know, all those things happen. And then what happened was I saw a TED Talk about the paradox of choice. Mm-hmm. And I watched it, and I was just, you know, really intrigued. Like, this was so interesting because it was data and it was research on how the more choices we have, the more stress we experience. And it was a kind of an older TED Talk. And so then I just started researching that. And I said, we have to have this in the book because this is our society today. And then when I was interviewing or, you know, talking with different publishing houses, and I'd have a whole team around asking me lots of questions, oh my gosh, these women would be like, oh, yeah, I was just up really late last night. I couldn't pick my toddler's pillow. And should I get organic? And what about the materials in it? And, you know, so it's like, it's again, in some ways, it's like we are on not just choice overload, but we're also on information overload. So we know And everything you can Google, anything and everything, right? So like, does that have red dye in it? Did that have this? Does it have formaldehyde? And,
yeah.
you know, and most of the things are scary. So you think, oh, well, thank goodness we know this. However, what it's doing is creating a fear of a culture of fear. And so we, you know, fear gets translated into stress, gets translated into not being able to make decisions and being indecisive. And that is what's happening. And like you said, it's from the microwave to the mattress to
yep.
schools. You know, I have, if you remember that part I have in the book, you know, school choice process. And I kind of go through my crazy
uh-huh.
process because where we are, you have school choice. And I go, and I looked it up. And at the time when I was writing this, you know, it was like in a 44-square-mile radius, I think there were 52 schools to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and they all have their specialty. And I think that on the outside, that looks like, well, such a privilege, right, and so amazing. Like, I could send my kid to a school that, like, has a farm or is green
yeah.
or has a STEM lab. But it's stressful, and at the end of the day, it also breaks up our communities. So here
yeah.
we go. So there it is.
Yeah, I know. And ultimately, and again, this from the perspective of someone whose children are older and moving out into the world, ultimately, all these choices that we spend forever trying to make really aren't the most important. They're not the most – our kids don't need all of this. And whether or not they go to the school with the farm or the STEM program or they go to the neighborhood school where their next-door neighbor goes, you know,
right.
it isn't life-altering in – but it's hard to think that in the moment. One of the things I'm going to be honest, I haven't done this exercise, but I'm going to. And it is to force yourself to choose from only three options for any decision that comes up this week. I've written that down on a sticky pad, and I have that taped to my bathroom mirror at home. I'm going to try to do that because I love to research, but I get totally caught up in it. And so I thought that was it will be a challenge, but I think it will be a good challenge for me. And a couple of other things you say for at the end of each chapter, you have a prescription plan for, and on the chapter talking about choice and the proliferation of choice or getting the best perfectionism or whatever, you talk about limiting your options for only two, limiting your children's choices and your own for only down to only two to three options, and shift from your mindset from the best, which is what captures me, to what works. What works well for my family, and get away from the idea that I need the best pillow for my kid or a mattress, the best mattress. You know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I really wanted to make sure we emphasize that one piece, and that always gets moms when I'm out and doing talks and, you know, doing this part of the talk with women. I say, and in fact, this isn't just preaching or an opinion. In fact, the research shows that giving our kids the very best and preventing them from having adversities in their life does not set them up for future success. They
mm-hmm.
have to experience adversity. They cannot have the very, very best of everything, or you get some outcomes that aren't favorable.
Mm-hmm.
And we have not just really with women's health crisis, we have an actual mental health crisis with our teenagers right now, and number one being anxiety. And one of the things that I am, of course, curious about is what's missing? So what's missing from teens mm-hmm. and young adults? You know, I don't know if you recently saw, but 2 weeks ago there was a study that came out, actually done, I think, by Cigna, that said, holy cow, the young adults ages 19 to 22 are actually lonelier than the geriatric population. Okay, and, you know, they've got one in five has an anxiety disorder, these kind of things. So I need to know, right? Well, what is causing this problem?
Yeah.
And the number one thing that we're looking at that they are missing are coping skills.
Yes.
Right? And doesn't it make sense? We have a generation that's sort of somehow gotten these messages like, we need to have the best, and they need to go to coding camp this summer, and they need to do this, and they have to have a STEM lab, and they blah, 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 blah. And
right.
what's so interesting is I think what we are forgetting is that through failure, through adversity, through hard times is how you build character, grit, relationships, confidence, problem-solving skills. I could go on and on. And so certainly that's one factor. If anything, if anybody got something from this conversation besides women connecting with friendships when it comes to raising your kids, is make sure first and foremost you take an assessment of what are your own coping skills, what do you model as coping skills, and what are you teaching your kids, and how much are you letting them fail or have adversity in their life so that they can build that up.
I so, because you're this, the age range you're talking about now is the age range my kids are in, and so I so totally see this and appreciate this, and partly I think technology is, so many parents now, parents and of my friends who have children the same age, are going to college, are bragging, we continue to talk 3 times a day. Oh yeah, we talk all the time. And I think that can't be good. I mean, that cannot be good for a child in college to not be able to make decisions. And in fairness, the children may be making decisions, but I sense that they're not. That they're still having their parents involved with the minutia of decision making. That we want our children to be able to fly the nest and be able to do. So I don't know if technology, from your research, have you seen that technology is part of that, or is it just the zeitgeist and everything that we're reading that makes us feel this way, that we have to be connected every second?
No, I mean, I sometimes I feel bad, but technology certainly plays a role in this. Just think about it. If in so many different levels, but you know, you have a problem, you have a question. What do you do? What do you think this generation does? Do they go and talk to somebody, talk to a guidance counselor, talk to a trusted adult, maybe a friend? You know, what do you imagine is their first go-to thing?
Google it.
Google it. That's it.
And
right?
I'm so guilty
you get
of
problems,
this.
Just Google it.
I'm worse than anybody in my family on that one, but you know, but you're
right. But you're not still developing, right? Your brain is already developed.
Oh, trust me, I'm
right?
Well past. Yeah, my brain is
right.
Off the
your brain is so developed.
Yeah, totally.
So, right. So, if you have a developing brain that is whatever, 16, 19 years old, and you've got a question, you're going to go to technology, right? You're going to. So now you're in college. And, you know, you just got your first test back, and it's a C. And maybe this kid's never even had a C before, ever. Why? Because they got a lot of help, right? They're bright, but maybe they got a lot of help and support. They're calling. I mean, there's books on this. They're calling home, talking to their – or whatever, texting home, talking to their parents about it. And then their parents are calling professors. You know, one of the books that I'm reading right now that I'm just telling everybody about, it's not new, but I just happened to read it this year, is How to Raise an Adult. And
I love
it.
Book. I do too.
I love that book, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I think, it, you know, it's from a couple years ago, and she was one of the people that really exposed as being a freshman dean at Stanford to say, I used to never even ever meet parents. Why would a freshman dean meet parents, right? Mm-hmm. And now they're on campus. They're calling me, emailing me, those kinds of things. So on so many levels, I really don't ever mom shame anybody. I'm not saying this as a joke or criticism. All of this comes from what we believe is love, but really it's fear, because you fear that if you don't do this, your child will be left behind because everybody else has these advantages. So even if intuitively you don't feel that great about doing it, you do it because you're like, I'm not going to let my kid not have an advantage. That's one part of it. But for the reason why I'm, you know, so passionate about all these topics and I really wrote this book is because for what my ultimate goal, what's my end game with this, is not just to have written a book and have people, you know, maybe get a couple tips or whatever, is to really have a movement, really change the way, you know, this generation, some Generation X, and lots of millennial parents, to change the way in which they are going to parent and in which they are going to raise adults, because it is having a very significant effect on everything, on our mental health, on our physical health, on our coping skills, on suicide rates. If we look over the last decade, a 70% increase in suicide rates for kids between the ages of 10 and 14. Like 10-year-olds are in the demographics. This is really serious stuff. We need to teach kids how to deal with problems, how to deal with feelings, and they're not going to get that online. They're only going to get that through relationship.
And sometimes they're going to get this from us backing up and letting them figure it out. There's a fine line there, because we certainly don't want to, if a child is struggling, to withdraw from them. But we can't always, and again, I'm speaking of children as they are, as I said, mine are flying the coop now, but we can't always be the one who solves their problems. We need to be perhaps a trusted advisor, if we're lucky, but we've got to allow them to step forward. I wanted to raise it's something I think about a lot, and I haven't seen the research on it, but it's something I think I see. Perhaps it's not universal. It feels like now that families, and I don't have the right words for it, but it feels to me like this next generation of people who are parenting children from, you know, 1 to 16 now, are very child-centered. The families are very child-centered. The parents are jumping through hoops. Everything revolves around the children, the children's schedule, the children's needs. And I feel it sounds so counterintuitive. It sounds almost selfish. It sounds like, but I wonder if it's not that it seems out of balance, that there should be some parent-centeredness in a family as well. And somehow intuitively, I just think it is better for children to know that they're in an orbit, but the center is the parents, and it has to lend a certain amount of security. Perhaps not. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Absolutely, on so many levels. Let me intro this by saying, like wrapping up that last part, you don't have to disengage from your child to let them experience adversity and problem solve. Maybe your role, just like you said, but I'll reiterate it, your role is to say, wow, gosh, you've got a problem. You know, the way I see it is here are the two choices I think you have, or here's, you know, two ways that I think you could solve it. So you can still be engaged, but just not rescuing and saving, okay? So I just want to make sure I really emphasize that point. I think in terms of a child-centered world or society right now that we live in the United States, that's absolutely what's going on. And the notion that mother, father are on the top and that children are second is something that's very old, very tried and true, and it is one of those things that's been around for a while that I think is the right way. This isn't one of those, like, let's get modern and put kids first. There's nothing good about a child, let's say a six-year-old child, feeling more powerful than their 30-year-old mom. There's nothing good that's going to come out of that. They do need to know their place. They need to know who makes the ultimate decision, because at the end of the day, it provides safety for them, physical and emotional safety for them.
Exactly.
Right?
So
that is, like, sometimes what happens is, this is an interesting trend I see, is we think that as parents, whatever our parents, a generation or grandparents did two generations ago before is outdated. And certainly there's always going to be some truth to that. There's stuff that we thought last year that might be outdated. So
sure. And
there's always
and
a grain of truth.
We have learned that are an improvement. I don't think you are either, saying that we should throw out all the science and stuff that we're learning.
Exactly. But there are also some things that aren't, I don't think they really are philosophical or even so subjective. They're child development focused. A child, and for me, definition of child meaning someone who you are in charge of. So I think up until 18 is what I'm talking about. Adolescents as well. They need to understand that their parent or parents that are raising them are ultimately making the decisions, are ultimately in charge. They have to trust that whatever decisions they're making are in the best interest, financially, emotionally, whatever that might be. They need to understand that. Otherwise, they're sort of risk-taking and having too much control in areas that ultimately makes them feel like they know they shouldn't have this much power. Mm-hmm. So it makes them feel insecure. So attachment is an area, I mean, anytime, of course, you work with foster or adopt kids, you need to understand trauma and attachment. And so from an attachment perspective, if you want to build a secure attachment, your child needs to know that ultimately you make the decisions. Now, you can certainly, and I don't think you need to justify them. I see there, to me, because I see it all the time, I think there's a fine line between justifying decisions that you make to your kids versus explaining them. And then there are certain times where you're going to do neither. And you're going to say, because this is the way it is, like the good old people.
And I don't want to debate it. Or sometimes
yeah,
I just
it's
say,
not
you
up
know,
for discussion.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I am a dictator, and on a good day, I'm a benevolent one. But you know what?
Yes.
That's just how it is, okay? I don't
That's
care.
That's how it's going to be. Right. I don't need to justify it to you or explain it in this particular, you know. And it's a ratio. And I think that, you know,
exactly.
what's so hard, of course, about parenting is there's so much gray and there's so much
exactly.
flexibility. You know, one day, how come I said yes? And then the next day, why did I say no? I mean, there's so many reasons that a child doesn't need to know. I mean, really, the reason could be because I'm just tired. Or I'd like to have that extra cookie last night because I just didn't – I was stressed and I didn't feel like listening to a tantrum. And I didn't, you know, I didn't have the oomph to deal with you yesterday, but today I do, you know. They don't
and
need
we can
to know
try
that.
To be consistent. But sometimes
we can try
the reality
to be consistent.
Is, but we're not sometimes.
Right. I mean, I think that people need that. Of course, if I were teaching a parenting class right now, if I said what are the pillars of like a healthy parent-child relationship, I would absolutely say consistency.
Sure.
However, consistency doesn't mean that you do the same thing every time. That's not consistency.
No.
Consistency, right, is that you maybe the quality is fairness. Right. And so, again, you know, sometimes my mom explains things to me. Sometimes she negotiates with me. Right. And sometimes she just says no. But I trust. The consistency is trust. I trust that she's making the right decision for us and I move on. That is the goal.
You tackled something in your book that I found interesting and that I have also seen. And in fact, had written an article on this a while back, and that's co-sleeping. And one of the things that I don't really have an opinion on co-sleeping, but I did a lot of interviews of families who co-slept. And what I found out through this, and again, this is not a scientific survey, but it was based on a fair number of interviews. And what I found out was that co-sleeping in most cases meant that the mom was sleeping with the kids and the dad was sleeping somewhere else. And I don't know if you if you actually said that in the book, but you talked about co-sleeping. And when you brought it up, I was going, boy, she's getting brave. Because let me tell you, you could start a massive online war by introducing or questioning co-sleeping. And my point was not necessarily to question it so much as to out it and saying, okay, what are we really talking about? So let's talk briefly. I know this could be a show in and of itself, but and this could be another hour-long interview. But let's talk about what you see with co-sleeping. And let me ask, have you also seen through your practice and through your research that co-sleeping is often mom with kids and dad elsewhere?
So, yes, it's so funny that, like, what we're about to talk about in this context has this sort of formal title, because the reason why it's in my book is because I think I put it this way, it's mommy's dirty little secret. And the dirty little secret is not intentional co-sleeping. The dirty little secret is that my kids will not sleep independent of me. So guess what? I sleep on their floor. I sleep in their twin bed. They come into our bed every single night. I have one kid who slept in the dog bed on the floor next to the mom. I mean, This is really what I'm talking about is more of, it's not intentional co-sleeping. It's my kid, for whatever reason, they have nightmares, they are insecure, whatever the reason is. The secret is you cannot imagine how many, and I'm not talking about babies, certainly not talking about babies, and I'm really not talking about toddlers. I'm talking about children. So I'm talking about school-age children, kindergarten above. You cannot imagine how many of them will not, they're sort of like, they hijack, or that's what it feels like to the parent. They hijack their parent. And like, you can't leave. You have to come back. I mean, I could have a full caseload of kids just in this situation. And I'm really not kidding you. Who the parents call and say, I can't do this anymore. I mean, I am so tired. I've got a 9-year-old that won't let me leave their room at night. And if I do, they will scream bloody murder. They'll run out. Sometimes they'll physically pull my shirt and pull me back in. And so it's common enough that I bring it up. So that's what why the sort of co-sleeping / child hijacking sleeping situation is in the book, because it's that common.
Yeah, I believe it. I absolutely believe it. And where children up to 9 and 10 are still having their parents physically sleep in the bed with them.
Physically and coming into their bed. Mm-hmm. And so what it leads to.
On that, as far as what does that lead to, and from your perspective?
You know, well, what happens is it's really an issue. I mean, it will eventually lead to a parent getting burned out. It really will. And they'll tell me that, you know, basically after dinner, around 7 o'clock at night, they're like, I physically get tense. My shoulders get tense. I start thinking about what nighttime is going to be like tonight. Am I going to do the battle? Because the thing about this problem is that if you simply say to your child, fine, go ahead and go sleep in my bed, or fine, I'll lay down with you and I'll stay here until you fall asleep. But what happens is they're so tired, they fall asleep. And then they wake up at midnight or 1 in the morning and have to get back to their bed. What happens is it has a huge trickle-down effect. It affects actually their sleep, right? So their quality of sleep, which is so important. It affects their marital relationship, or, you know, the relationship with their partner in terms of intimacy.
Not just sex.
That's exactly literally what's going to come out of my mouth. Not just sexual intimacy, just intimacy. You're exactly right, though. It's just cuddling or talking, just talking,
talking
at night.
Yeah.
You know, you're right, laying in bed or laying on the couch and, you know, maybe watching a show together or whatever it is that you adults like to do to wind down when their kids are finally in bed and sleeping, which is getting later and later these days. You know, it really interferes with that. It certainly can interfere with a working mom's schedule when she's like, you know, basically this is like my third or fourth shift of the day, and I return emails for an hour or so at night. And when I fall asleep with my kid and I wake up groggy and my contacts are still in and, you know, I haven't brushed my teeth, I'm still in my clothes, whatever it might be, it's pretty disruptive, you know. And the kids, when they're in this mode, they honestly don't care. It is all about them, their fear, what they're working through. So, you know, this is one of those times where it goes back to even what we were talking about, where parents have to decide. Every parent has to pick and choose their battles. By the time they see me, they approached it with, you know, hey, well, it's not that bad. I just lay with them until they fall asleep. And, you know, it's been an evolution. By the time, of course, they're coming to me, they're ready for change. They've had it. Sometimes the kids are ready for change, but for the most part, they're so scared and they can't regulate themselves enough to fall asleep and stay asleep in their own room that they see what it's doing to their parents, but it's not motivating enough. You know, their needs are more motivating. So it's a pretty big problem, and so that's why I write about it. And I still think this is a secret. I don't think this is something too freely that parents are going to go, my 9 and 10-year-old, blah, 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 every single night. It's just because they're also being protective of their own child. It looks like a weakness on their part, you know, or something that's not desirable.
No, I hear you. One of the interesting things, although not interesting from my, I mean, not surprising, I mean, from my standpoint, the number of examples that you gave in the book of moms who were suffering from burnout who had faced infertility, and you also struggled with infertility.
Right.
And it that was an interesting thing, and I quite frankly, I didn't expect it. I mean, I didn't necessarily think that the infertility that moms who had experienced infertility would have a higher rate of burnout. And I'm not sure you said that they had a higher rate, but they certainly played heavy in the examples. And then then it made sense to me. And I wonder is it because moms who have experienced infertility have usually had to work so very hard to get their kids through either successful treatment or through adoption, and they have built up this idea of what motherhood is going to be. And quite frankly, you know, a lot of motherhood is a combination of boring and anxiety making, you know, and it's still wonderful, but it's not exactly, you know, it's not all, you know, fireworks
in fact, if it's fireworks, it's usually a tantrum. So
right.
Is that the reason, or do you see it more often? So how does infertility or the struggle to become a mom impact the likelihood or the prevalence of being burnt out?
Well, it's such a unique factor in motherhood, and I think that it starts off your journey in a really different place than the, you know, the couple who just tried for, you know, 1 or 2 months and boom, got pregnant, or the many couples who are like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know I was pregnant until I was, you know, whatever, 12 weeks along, you know.
Yeah.
And I know a mom struggling with fertility, that makes her cringe inside.
It does.
Right? And so what makes it so unique is the emotional toll. It is such a lonely, lonely process to be going through infertility.
Sure.
Or waiting for adoption. You know, international adoptions are long and costly and so stressful,
right? So
are
domestic infant adoptions, yeah. They're long and costly,
certainly.
Too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly. I just think of all of these moms, though, that, you know, maybe they've identified a 9-month-old in China or in Africa somewhere, and they have to wait until they're 2, 2.5 years old to take them home.
Mm-hmm.
And you're worried about them. You think about them. You know, make these costly trips to visit them. So I think infertility and adoption just starts off motherhood in a really different place. But my unique angle on it, from what I have seen and even personally experienced, is, you know, so you start off unique, maybe not like the average mom, right? It's not an average situation. However, I think that after the first year, you very quickly go into the mode of like every other mom. Now you do join the ranks of typical mom feelings, experiences. And what happens uniquely for them, and I'll say for myself as well, is you've got this feeling, this nagging thought, I'm not allowed to complain. I tried, you know, 3 rounds of IVF. We spent $50,000 on doctors, blah, blah, blah. We waited 3 years for this. How could I possibly call a friend or my mom or my mother-in-law and say, I have had it. I'm so exhausted. You don't feel like you can do that. So now the process becomes lonelier because you don't even have an outlet. At least moms, they do. Today's moms definitely complain a lot to each other, and they tell each other, you know, those kinds of things. It wouldn't be unusual in the morning at drop-off to be like, whoo, we had quite the morning, you know, and just sometimes a 2-minute exchange, it just is validating, right? Because someone else goes, oh, yeah, we had one of those the other day, and da-da-da-da-da, you know, and then you go on with your day, and it just felt good to talk about it. So I wanted to be true to my motherhood experience because I have 3 children, and my first 2 I really struggled with, and the toll that it took on me as feeling like a failure, the toll that it took. I mean, I really would say things like, I am a woman. Like, I am here to reproduce children that I'm dying to have, and I couldn't have it, you know. And then the toll it took on my marriage, you know, at times we were connected. At times I was like, oh, you have no idea what I'm going through. At times when it would be yet another month of not getting pregnant and my husband kind of going, oh, man, all right, well, there's always next month, and me just wanting to feel like I wanted to rip his head off, because for me it wasn't just, oh, man, let's try again next month. It was heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just have experienced it myself, treated it myself, seen it so much myself. It's kind of, in a way, similar to postpartum depression, you know, in which women, again, what – yeah, postpartum, you know, depression, women, you know, you've got this beautiful, let's say, 3-month-old. Well, who thinks that they can just say to whoever came to visit them, actually, I'm really unhappy, and I don't want to hold my baby. You hold my baby. I want to stay in bed. I don't want to go to a mommy and me class. I don't want, you know, so if there's, and that's shame, right? At the root of all of those examples are this shame, and that's really part of my mission, is to have places and communities, we didn't talk about that, but not just friendships and also communities that we feel we belong to, in which we can really have an authentic experience share about motherhood.
And I also, before you go, I want to also talk about another aspect of our, speaking of community, of our community, is parents who have adopted children who have experienced trauma, who have adopted older kids, who have adopted kids with special needs. You talk about loneliness. There is a special loneliness
when your kid doesn't fit any mold, and the type of parenting you feel like you need to do for this child is a different type of parenting that's often not understood. Can you talk a little about that? I mean, talk about burnout. Of course they're burnt out. They're exhausted. Parenting a child who's experienced trauma is an exhausting thing to do.
Absolutely. And this is where, in terms of where my experience most heavily lies, it's right here, working with traumatized kids and then working with their families and training their families and doing all those kinds of things. And what I will say is there's nothing like a wonderful family or couple wanting to help another human being out, right? And doing so and wanting to grow their family and really bring them in, and then having that child not securely attached, continue to fail at school, tell you every day how much they hate you, glorifying maybe a biological parent who may have been abusive or is incarcerated or those kinds of things, or glorifying a biological parent who they've never even met. So there's nothing that I can imagine that requires that level of resilience. And that's what I see. There's a level of resilience that special needs parents, but specifically special needs parents of adopted and foster care adopt kind of situations, that, yes, community is the key, because the notion that generally no one understands is not just like a saying or an exaggeration. It's truth.
It's true.
People think, well, you know, the Smiths are such a lovely family. How fortunate that little Johnny was adopted by them and joining their family. And then they realize, like, love is not enough in these situations. You cannot love a child. Now, love plays an important role, but I feel pretty strongly about this. You know, you can't just love a child out of the trauma and the rejection and sort of sometimes the atrocities that they've been through. It requires so much. That's just what I would say about that, like making sure that those families are a part of regular, not just sometimes, but regular ongoing community get-togethers, groups, parent meetings. You know, one thing I will say about technology, it's not all negative. I will say that some of the special needs kinds of groups, any kind, whatever it's going to be, that are online, that are big and that are strong and that are really supportive and moderated well, which sounds like your community, and that there's sort of ground rules that people understand, and if you break them, you're out. Those can be a lifeline, because a lot of the situations that moms with kids with special needs have occur late at night, you know, at times where even if you had somebody to call, you can't. And there's just nothing like being able to go on to, you know, a Facebook group that's private and just say, I just had a hell of a night, and have, you know, 75, 100 people support you.
Exactly.
That's really valuable.
I so agree with you. And I agree. I was sitting here inwardly smiling, thinking, well, the problem is one of the best ways to finding this community is online. And we had already talked about how that isn't necessarily, but a place where you can vent about what your experience is for people who have been there and understand and won't judge, because oftentimes we're not at our best at these moments either. So having people reach out and giving you practical suggestions, and sometimes just supporting and just saying, "Man, that must have been a hard experience. I know it's hard. I've had a similar experience, and boy, it's hard." And creating a family does have one. It's a closed Facebook group, and you can find it by typing in the words "creating a family" in the search book, in the Facebook search box.
Yeah, and let me just say one more thing about that, so that if there's someone listening from start to finish, can I say this?
Please.
Oh, okay. If someone heard us talking about sort of social media from the beginning about friendships to here, I actually see them as two different things, because what I was saying about friendships is sort of a one-on-one intimate connection in which, you know, you share your highs and lows and everything in between. However, belonging to community is different. You could walk into, let's say, a church or a synagogue and sit in the back and never talk to anybody and still have a sense that you belong in that community. You can still get online late at night. You're probably never going to meet any of these people in this huge Facebook group and just say, I had a hell of a day, dot, dot, dot. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know you've got a place to go. Or my doctor just told me that my child was diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder. Anybody else, anybody know anything about this? And you know that you're going to get dozens of responses back. It's a difference. And that does serve a purpose in belonging to that community. Now, do I, of course, advocate for face-to-face? Yes, but there is a definite role and a gift, I think, in the online community that I don't want downplayed. And then there's also a need for us to have one-on-one, person-to-person, in face or on the phone interaction. So I just wanted to make that distinguishment.
Thank you, That is important because I totally agree with you, and not just because I run a really large group, but what we need both. And one way, and it'd be great if you had this type of community in person, but that's hard to find because, you know, unless you live in a really large, and then it's, you know, the meetings are few and far between, and what you need is that night when you've had a really tough night to be able to share. Before I let you go, I wanted to say that there were two times in reading the book, and again, the book is Mommy Burnout, How to Reclaim Your Life and Raise Healthier Children in the Process, and the author is Dr. Cheryl Ziegler, a psychotherapist as well. There were two times I gave you a standing ovation. One, I'm going to tell you now what they are. One was you have I wish I could tell you the page. I don't remember. You had somewhere in the book that we need to ban busy as a badge of honor. And I honestly stood up and went, yes. And I say that as somebody who I think fell prey to that, certainly. I had an epiphany once. I was sitting with a group of women, all moms, and we were, everybody was complaining about how busy we were, And at the time, I was astronomically busy. I had taken on way too much and was just, I was chiming right in, and all of a sudden I had this thought. I went, stop. We're bragging. We're all bragging as if this is something to be proud of. And then I looked around and I thought, okay, Dawn, you've won. Okay, if the busyness war, you won. How does that make you feel? And I'm saying this all to myself. And I made a vow right then that I would never complain. I was going to stop. I was not going to participate in the busy competition. Now, I'm not sure I actually kept that promise, but I certainly tried. So that was one time I gave you this massive standing ovation. And then another thing you talk about in the book, and you talk about it throughout, although there's a chapter when you really talk about it, and it was focusing time and energy on your marriage. And I, as someone who has been married a long time and whose children are now leaving, I can't stress enough how much I agree with you that the relationship that's going to, the ongoing relationship is one and of your marriage. And the second, of course, your relationship with your kids exists, but it is just so important. And marriages need time and energy. So I will give you a chance now to speak since I've just had a monologue on my two standing ovation moments. But I'll let you have the last word.
You can go on and on. You're giving me a standing ovation. That's fantastic, and I really, truly appreciate that. You know, you never know what is going to resonate with people, and I'd love to hear that. So, yes, the first one, you definitely hit the nail on the head. You know, you see a mom and you're like, hey, how's it going? Oh, my gosh, it's going. I'm super busy. And the other one goes, oh, yeah, me too. I'm crazy busy. And so instantly we just set up a barrier right there in that moment. And I talk about this. I did a TEDx talk called Why Moms Are Miserable in November. And that is what I talk about, where you have these moments where you think that you've just worn your badge of honor, because if I tell you that I'm busy, then I'm important, right? Because if I'm not busy, what does that say about me? Oh, my gosh, I've got nothing going on in my life.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not
a slacker.
Right? Right, I'm a real slacker. So I've got to say I'm busy, because that's the thing to do, is to say you're busy. So I really push that, and that really weaves into the message around friendship. You want to create just even relationships and connections, you got to stop saying you're busy, because people won't go to you.
Yeah.
They won't go to you. They won't ask you for favors. They won't even ask you for a glass of wine, because every time they see you, you look frazzled and you say that you're busy. And probably those are the moms that more than anybody could really use a night out and could really use a connection. We could all use it. So that's that one piece. And the marital piece, sure, an entire chapter on the marriage, of course, because burnout, and let me tell you how much I have heard from the men and the dads. Where's the daddy burnout? Why
we
didn't
got a
you
question
talk about
from
that?
Ian asking that exact question. What can daddies learn from mommy burnout? So, yes. Tell us about that.
So, you know, the dads have what dads can learn from mommy burnout, truly. And I've had actually been pleasantly surprised that there have been many men who have read the book themselves and said, I learned so much about my wife, and we had such great conversations because I just asked her, is this how you feel? Is this what's going on in your life? You know, and it's opened great conversations. So that's what dads could, and there's so many just stress management tools that anybody could use. That's what dads could learn from it. But the dads that are like uprising to me are just sort of like, I want you to acknowledge that we also feel burnout and that we are very much can be the victim of burnout in our wives. And so I say to them, that is true. I mean, I talk in the book about, you know, men feel oftentimes like they pretty quickly, oh, this is the way it is. Baby comes first. I'm a far second. Sometimes my wife doesn't even look at me when I walk in the door. She doesn't ask me about my day anymore. However, they're starting to accept that this is, I guess this is what being a mom means. You know, you've got your kids around, and so I'm a far second. And so either they become pretty unhappy in their marriages and they kind of go along with that, or the other thing that happens is they're so craving and dying for attention and physical, you know, affection and all of that, that they notice that their wives are totally ignoring them. When you're in burnout, you don't feel very sexy, and you don't want to be touched, and you don't, you know, want to do any of that kind of stuff. So the stories that I have in that chapter are, you know, ones about how women dodge their husbands. But the flip side of that is that men know it. You know, they know that you're doing it. And, you know, sometimes they hang in there for it, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes there's big fights. It just depends on the personality, but it's a real problem. And again, it goes to the spirit of the book. The book is first and foremost, what's different about this book is that it's very, very adult women focused, right? But if you do those things, the consequences are that you are a better parent, your kids are healthier and happier, and your relationship is stronger. And that's where the spirit for me is I really want to emphasize the point, we come first, and everything around us gets better. Our work gets better, our husbands and our relationships get better, our kids do better. If we can put ourselves first and take care of our needs first and not lose ourselves in parenting. So that's what I would say.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Cheryl Ziegler, for talking with us today. Again, the title of the book is Mommy Burnout, How to Reclaim Your Life and Raise Healthier Children in the Process. You can get the book, of course, on Amazon. You can also go to your local bookseller. We want to encourage you to do that. And if they don't have it, and they probably do, but if they don't have it, ask them to get it for you because other people will want it too. Or you can go to her website, mommyburnout.com, and you can buy the book at that point as well. I highly, highly recommend the book. It is both practical as well as it's not humorous so much, but it's a good read. And from an older mom or a mom of older kids, I can tell you it rings so true. Let me break for a moment and remind you that this show could not happen and would not happen without the generous support of our partners. One of our partners is Vista Del Mar. They are a licensed and accredited nonprofit adoption agency with over 65 years of experience helping to create families. They have three adoption programs, a private infant program, an international program, and an adoption through foster care program. So you can check them out by going to our website, and under our partners, you will see them, and we appreciate, we truly do appreciate their support. Thank you for being with us today, then I will see you all next week.
Everything you're hearing is from the Home Depot, from the baseboards and nails, to these throw pillows, even those super soft sheets. Because now at the Home Depot, you can get everything for your bedroom, from wooden nightstands to modern benches. Save up to 25% on select bedroom furniture, plus free and flexible delivery and easy in-store returns. Shop decor now at HomeDepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items, $45 or more. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.
Now at the Home Depot, save up to 35% off appliance special buys. Like the Samsung stainless steel side-by-side refrigerator, just $9.98. You save $300. It's big enough to hold 25 bags of groceries. Unload those, and if that makes you thirsty, you'll really love the external ice maker and water dispenser. Today is the day for doing. Spring Black Friday savings now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only, while supplies last. See store for details, valid through April 17th.